New York Times co-chief theater critic Ben Brantley will discuss the current state of Broadway theater and his approach to reviews at the upcoming Columbia County Habitat Fall Brunch, happening this Sunday, November 4th, from 11:30 to 1:30. Brantley has been with the New York Times since 1993, filing reviews regularly from London as well as New York. He has notably reviewed everything from Hamilton to Chicago to the Book of Mormon, among countless other productions. Again, he will be speaking on Sunday, November 4th from 11:30 to 1:30 at the Columbia County Habitat Fall Brunch. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Ben Brantley to the roundtable this morning. Ben, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. And by the way, I've been at the Times 25 years, which I believe was the 1993 was the year that the Columbia County chapter of Habitat for Humanity was formed. So it's an anniversary of sorts for both of us. Quarter of a century. I started just out of college. Yeah.
What has that been like for you in the sense of it seems as though for someone who wants to write about theater that you go right from college to the major leagues?
No, I was just joking. No, I was. I'd actually had quite a life before I went to the Times.
Okay, so really?
Yeah. No, I started off, my first job out of college was at Women's Wear Daily. I covered fashion for them. I was the chief fashion critic, and then I was the Paris bureau chief. From there, I went to work for Tina Brown, first at Vanity Fair,
right,
the editor I'm talking about, and then The New Yorker, and then The Times since 1993.
What has it been about The New York Times, of going to that newspaper to cover theater and as I said, to really hit the major leagues of doing what you want to do, writing about theater, and I assume that is what you wanted to do.
It was what I always wanted to do. The very first job interview I ever had in New York was with John Fairchild, then the publisher of Women's Wear Daily. He said, if you could have any job in the world, what would it be? And I said, theater critic of the New York Times. That was just thrown out there. I didn't expect it to materialize, but it did.
So in doing that, what have you learned over the past quarter of a century in doing this job?
Oh, so much. First of all, it's wonderful to be in a job where you have to pay attention. I mean, sort of the opposite of Homer Simpson, if you know what I mean. Of course, he should be paying attention in light of the nuclear disasters he's caused. But I found almost as soon as I started the job, because you have to focus so completely when you're watching a play, that extended to life outside. If I were stuck in a taxi, suddenly I'd be aware of the drama on the street. It keeps your mind fresh. And every time you see a play, whether it's good or bad, it's a different language. You kind of have to become fluent in that language while you're watching. And I've learned so much about so many different cultures, too, because the voices of playwrights, still not as ideally as diverse as we'd like, they are so myriad. And especially in the early years, I got to see so many productions from other nations, from Africa and from Asia and Russia, at, for example, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So it's been a great sort of endless graduate school for me.
When you think of that school and going to the shows, and obviously we think about Broadway, but all of the theater that you cover, not only on Broadway, but throughout the country, throughout the world, and looking at these productions, one of the things that you'll be talking about at the brunch is the current state of theater. Over that 25-year time, where are we right now, do you think?
I actually think we're in surprisingly good shape. When I started, what interested me most, and still does to some extent, are the experimental theaters, the ones that are off-Broadway, sort of the holes in the wall. And unfortunately, as New York has become more prohibitively expensive and sort of cut off the flow of youth without trust funds coming into the city, you don't see quite as much as that. But you do see a lot coming in from other places, from institutional theaters throughout the country and in New York, and then landing on Broadway. And I think much more interesting sort of feast of plays, more diverse certainly than when I first started, and it's a pretty exciting season right now. Last year, my co-chief theater critic Jesse Green and I, and three fellow critics at the Times and the theater editor Scott Heller, assembled a list of the 25 greatest plays of the 25 past years. It was pegged to a revival of Angels in America, which was obviously a benchmark when it came out in 1993, right, on Broadway. And it was fascinating to see how many of the playwrights are African American, of color, how much is about race right now, and how that has lent itself, I think, to new forms as well as subjects that for many years weren't explored in mainstream theater. A writer like Susan Laurie Parks, who had our top slot, is just so endless. She seems to reinvent the play every time she writes it. So that's especially exciting. This season, I mean, just in the past week, I had two reviews in this week, two Broadway reviews in any case, both of plays I'd seen before in other contexts. The first was Ferryman by Jez Butterworth, and that, I don't know if you know his work.
I do.
British playwright who did Jerusalem, which when I saw it, I thought was pretty astonishing. He thinks so big, not just in terms of the literal canvas. I mean, the new play, The Ferryman, has 21 speaking parts, and that doesn't count the goose and the baby and the rabbits who appear as well. But also in terms of sort of centuries. I mean, everything he writes, it has this kind of mythic sweep to it. And even though it's always happening in the present tense, in this case, it's a harvest day at a farm in rural Northern Ireland, it seems to encompass so much. I mean, going back to, you know, the divisions within Ireland is, I mean, since forever, it sort of not only name checks the Easter Rising, but has someone who is a witness to it. And it's just bursting with life. It's also beautifully constructed. And when you see a play like that, it just makes the world seem larger, and it makes you want to expand your own gaze upon the world. The other Broadway show that opened last night was a play I'd seen first in 2000 by Kenneth Lonergan called The Waverly Gallery. Right. And it's a portrait of his grandmother, a woman with Alzheimer's. But starring in it this season is Elaine May, who is 86 years old, who, of course, is legendary.
Nichols and May.
Part of the team. Nichols and May. And basically playing a woman who, as she's losing her mind, is improvising. I mean, really trying to sort of fill in the blanks, even when she doesn't know what she's talking about. And, of course, you know, who better to do that than Elaine May, who made an art of that with Mike Nichols. Here, the existential stakes are quite a bit higher. But it is a beautiful production.
I think the term you use in your review is impeccably acted. We never seem to be, while some of the content can be questionable, there is just wonderful acting in
the Oh, I'm always astonished by the range of performers. I mean, in terms of just competence, I still think New York, well, in London too, are untoppable in that kind of training. And then there are those people who take it one step further and remind you of why stage stars had such a kind of aura about them for so many years in the American and British and international theater. Two veteran actresses who are appearing off-Broadway at the moment are Stockard Channing and Glenn Close, both very familiar names. Stockard Channing, of course, from The West Wing, among many other things. And Glenn Close for, well, so many movies that we remember. They're both curiously playing mothers, sort of a monster mother in Stockard Channing's case in Apologia, about a revered art critic, but very intimidating woman who has to sort of reckon with the children she neglected, the two sons. Whereas Glenn Close is playing the mother of Joan of Arc in a play called Mother of the Maid. And gosh, to see her at the Public Theater in a small space, she just has that kind of old barnstorming presence, as well as a real intelligence and precision in acting that just, it's so exciting when that happens. And of course, we'd all seen her, a year ago in Sunset Boulevard, which was a very different kind of performance on Broadway.
How do you generally feel about revivals? I know Torch Song is being revived. There are many others.
Yes, I'm seeing that tonight.
So how do you feel about going into a production like that, assuming obviously you'd seen it originally, of what that feels like for you?
Well, in a sense, Broadway has become a little like the Metropolitan Opera. Do you know, there's sort of a floating repertory that seems to keep coming back. We've got A Kiss Me, Kate looming on the horizon with Kelly O'Hara, which I feel like I reviewed just yesterday, although it was, I believe, more like 18 years. Another All My Sons coming with Annette Bening. I always think, oh no, not this again. And then so often I'm surprised. If the plays are good enough, like any time, the first time I was so gratefully aware of this was when I was first in the job and I reviewed Janet McTeer, who is now on Broadway in Bernhardt Hamlet. Teresa Rebeck's play is Sarah Bernhardt. But this was a production imported from London of A Doll's House. And I thought, I don't need to see A Doll's House again. I'd studied it in college. It seemed to me rather dry, ultimately, doctrinaire. But directed by Anthony Page and starring Janet McTeer, who is a very tall, kind of athletic woman, as the doll-like wife, clearly sort of confined to a role that didn't suit her, as if she'd been sort of laced into a corset that was strangling her. It was thrilling, and I thought, don't ever think you know something unconditionally until you see it performed in another way. This very season at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn, there's a revival of Oklahoma, which you must think you know backwards and forwards if you're an American fan of the musical theater.
The Bard production, right?
This one came from Bard, which is where I first saw it. Daniel Fish's production.
It's beautiful.
It's a, did you see it?
I did, yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it?
It really
doesn't
is.
It tell you just, I mean, it without really changing the text. As a matter of fact, I think the text and songs are pretty much intact. It shows you so many layers of sort of what's beneath, the kind of anxiety and hostility and friction that must have existed to live in those times and that Rodgers and Hammerstein really captured. It finds shadows in Oklahoma and a sort of raw, uncertain sexuality that was always there. It's a very haunting production. So I'm grateful for that. My motto in reviewing it is try not to anticipate. Go there and let yourself be surprised. And sometimes, yes, it will be a sort of pro forma, yeah, you know. I mean, Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, when they did The Odd Couple some years ago, it was like kind of like Why, except we're bringing Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane back to sort of trade on the chemistry they'd had in The Producers. But the Waverly Gallery, I mean, the chance to see Elaine May in that part and to see her, turning into something. I just loved it the first time I saw it with Eileen Heckert, who has since passed away. But Elaine May, it's just, I mean, that's, I mean, how lucky can we be to have her come back at this point and give us the gift of this nuanced but totally in the moment, very funny, very tragic performance.
Ben Brandley is our guest. He's going to be discussing the current state of Broadway theater and its approach to reviews at the upcoming Columbia County Habitat Fall Brunch on November 4th. And you can find out more by going to columbiacountyhabitat.org. With all that you just said and keeping an open mind and going into these shows, the theater, the cynic in you, perhaps a small percentage, but when you see that a Beetlejuice is coming or a Pretty Woman is coming or even a King Kong is coming, do your eyes roll a bit?
Sure. I mean, how could they not? And it seems to me kind of a lazy formula. Okay, hit movie. Let's see if we can trade on that. And sometimes your cynicism is justified, as it was with this production of Pretty Woman, which actually you realize how invaluable Julia Roberts was to the charm of that original movie of dubious taste and politics about women, I think. But on the other hand, in Boston this summer, I saw a stage adaptation of Moulin Rouge,
yes.
The Baz Luhrmann movie.
Stunning.
It was thrilling. You saw that too.
I got to
see
that, yes.
Yeah, wasn't that exciting?
It is exciting.
Yeah. And you think, I mean, it was such a cinematic piece that you thought, well, I mean, does this really lend itself to theater? And I get a little tired of jukebox musicals, but this one was like the jukebox that had imploded. I mean, it was just fragments of songs coming from everywhere. And finally, it became sort of this comment on love songs and the myths of love songs and how we apply them to stories in our own lives and sort of immortal stories, kind of like La Traviata, which is what Moulin Rouge is to some extent. And Beetlejuice, I'm happy to say, is being directed by the man who did Moulin Rouge. It's Alex Timbers, very, very talented man whose career I followed since he was a member of an absurdist troupe called Les Frères Corbusier for no reason whatsoever. He did a Scientology Christmas pageant, a very merry Scientology Christmas pageant years ago with all children in the cast that was just wonderful as they reenacted the stories and rituals of Scientology.
One of the shows that I'm most excited to see this fall, and a lot of this has to do with Aaron Sorkin, is To Kill a Mockingbird, which will be opening in December. There was some court action in this first time, obviously, that the estate had allowed a play to be done, and then some concern about the direction. What do you make of that? I mean, obviously, it's an iconic book, it's an iconic film, and now it will be on stage.
Yeah. I mean, I think the estate sort of muddied their own waters when they released the sequel. What is it? Ghost Out of Watchmen.
Right.
Which gave us a different perspective on Atticus Finch, who was one of the great heroic prototypes for many people, you know, anti-racist, man standing up alone for justice and so forth. And suddenly we saw a slightly different perspective on him. And I do think that in adapting something to the stage, you don't want to be too literal-minded. You want to capture the flavor of the book. Again, I don't judge in advance, but Jeff Daniels seems to me to be an ideal choice. I like it that they cast young adult actors as opposed to children in those parts. I mean, clearly it's going to be sort of not a commentary on the story necessarily. I mean, although that's implicit in however anything's staged, but it's giving us a stage version. I mean, I mentioned A Doll's House earlier. One of the great plays in recent years was Lucas Hennes' A Doll's House Part 2, this was the sequel, sort of, the story of what happened when Nora came home after slamming the door 15 years later. And what I loved so much about it was that it continued the conversation Ibsen had started. And for whatever reasons, To Kill a Mockingbird is so much a part of our national conversation now, when issues of race are so paramount. So to bring that into the 21st century, I mean, I'm nearly 20 years into the 21st century, while retaining why it was such a cherished book for so many generations of school children. I mean, I imagine you read it when you were like 10 or 11 years old, as I did too. So it's going to be a balancing act. Aaron Sorkin is the adapter on it, and he certainly has proven his mettle in film and television. The Social Network, I still think, is an amazing achievement in movies. So that I'm very much looking forward to. But as I say, I don't judge. I mean, you read what you can before you go. You certainly want to have a sense of context for when you go back and you actually write the review. But when you're sitting down and seeing something and you're in the dark waiting for the lights to come up, you want to be a blank slate. You want to be a virgin. I mean, you want to, it's as if it's the very first time, whether you've seen it 100 times before, and you want to be seduced again.
You did get criticism over your review of Head Over Heels, the Go-Go's musical. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. It's, as a matter of fact, I'd been so careful because the woman who plays the romantic lead in it is a woman of large dimensions, very attractive and so forth, but it was clearly sort of casting against the usual sort of boring type. So I wanted to make sure I didn't in any way patronize her. And, you know, I've been writing about trans performers, I mean, basically since I've been in the job. Kate Bornstein, who recently appeared in Straight White Men, I reviewed when she was at Public Space 122 when I was first in the job, and she is a trans woman. And it was the first time I think we had a trans performer on the dress page, as we call it, of the arts section. What people were objecting to was, in fact, pretty much directly from the play, where I talked about a character who had been married to another character but hadn't been able to accept this character's multidimensionality sexually. And so I said, he finds himself strangely drawn to her, excuse me, I mean them, because at the end he says they rather than she.
Right.
And that was perceived as a flippant dismissal of the importance of pronouns to trans people. And it wasn't my intention, and I immediately, perhaps too hastily, wrote an apology that was posted. Because it wasn't what I intended at all. I think if I had liked the show more, there would have been less. They would have taken less umbrage with my seemingly flippant use of pronouns.
You had mentioned this earlier, but as co-chief theater critic, the fact that you now have a counterpart who shares your title after you held that title alone for so long, do you still feel good about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's Jesse Green, who, if you know him, is just one of the true mensches of this universe. And once a month, we sit down, we look at the month ahead of us and say, how are you going to divide this? And it's just fun. It takes a little of the intense focus off you as being, you know, part of the white patriarchy critical establishment.
How do you decide? Is that decision made for you? How did the two of you decide you're going to do?
No, we do it together. Sometimes we actually even review together. For example, Oklahoma we did as a joint review, which is kind of fun. And we do conversations that are make it into print online where we're just sort of, you know, riffing off of each other. The two, the co-chief movie critics, Manola Dargis and A.O. Scott, operate similarly. I think it's a pretty good system.
When you look at the event that you'll be having on the 4th of November and you get to go out and talk to your where you spend much of your time, I assume you enjoy those opportunities.
No. I don't. I hate giving talks.
That's a very honest reaction. Okay. Excellent.
But I do them because I feel like, I mean, this is such a, I mean, worthy is a damning word, but it is a very honorable thing at a moment when the idea of homelessness looms so large on so many levels. So I'm not happy to do it, but I think it's something I should do. I try to avoid speeches. I will talk to classes, to students. I never say no to that. But no, speaking, I find one of the few things I haven't liked about the job is having to be a public presence. I'm essentially a very private person, and in the best of all possible worlds, I would be invisible and write without a byline.
But you do get those moments when the house lights go down and it's you in a dark room,
and that's thrilling. Yeah, I'm a pair of eyes looking at the stage and a very receptive heart and mind, I like to think.
Ben Brantley is the New York Times co-chief theater critic. He'll be discussing the current state of Broadway and his approach to reviews at the upcoming Columbia County Habitat Fall Brunch, Sunday, November 4th, 11:30 to 1:30 at the Society of New Concord on County Road 9 in East Chatham, New York. You can find out more information all about it by going to ColumbiaCountyHabitat.org. Ben Brantley, I'm a fan. I thank you very much for spending time with us, and I wish you all the best of luck in the coming season.
Well, I certainly enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Again, you can find out more information about Ben Brantley at the Columbia County Habitat Fall Brunch on November 4th by going to ColumbiaCountyHabitat.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.